This is the Podcast Express, and we're talking to whoever's listening out there. Welcome to 5 Minutes of Trouble, the only podcast on the internet that discusses the John Carpenter film Big Trouble in Little China 5 minutes at a time. I'm Josh Horowitz from the Wing Kong Exchange at www.wingkong.net.
I'm Brett Stillo. I'm sitting in the passenger seat. And today, Josh, we have two guests.
Two guests.
Sure. Yes, yes.
Who could they be?
Who would they be? Number one, we have actress, writer, producer, and burlesque hostess, Mistress Hall of Fame, Miss Audra Wolfman.
Hi.
Welcome, Audra.
And we also have Mr. Desmond Miller, writer and host of the podcast, The Geek Chat.
Hello, Desmond.
Hello.
Welcome.
Real voice.
Yeah, no, hello. Welcome both of you guys to our podcast.
It is great to be here. And actually, can I just say, I am thrilled to be the first female ever on a podcast.
Ever.
Wow.
Ever.
In the history of podcasts.
You realize you have to play Gracie Law now. Just saying. You have the same red hair. So.
Well, since you're the first woman on a podcast, let's explain podcasts to you.
Yeah. Can you explain? What is this thing in my hand that I'm talking into?
Oh, that.
Yeah. I don't understand science. It's hard.
That's called a magic voice tube.
That's great. Thank you.
Yes. You can't do your hair with it, okay?
I guess you could. You can roll it.
Yeah, can you mansplain this to me?
I guess I'll mansplain the whole thing to
you. Leave that up to Kurt Russell.
Who is a master of mansplaining.
Yes. Serious mansplainer.
Maybe not Kurt. That might not be fair. We'd have to ask Goldie about that, really. But I think Jack Russell?
Jack Russell.
Jack Russell.
Me.
Oh, he's
Jack Russell.
Oh, you're dogged and relentless. Oh,
you guys got this from here. I'm just going to roll down the window,
Jack
jump
Russell
out of the truck.
D Terrier.
So if we're in a truck, are we like in the sleeper back cabin, kind of like yelling out?
Yes, you are.
Actually, we're in our apartment. We just wrecked the place.
Yeah.
Well, we are actually here to discuss a very interesting film, Big Trouble in Little China. But Audra, yes, we're doing this 5 minutes at a time. So hopefully you're familiar with these 5 minutes, minutes 30 through 35. They are interesting minutes, a little bit different than the last 5 minutes. Not as action-packed, but definitely full of characters. For this one, we actually have the minutes starting with Jack Burton ranting about running over Lopan, and they end with Jack disguised as Henry Swanson saying how he will pay with cash.
These are five important minutes. This is an exposition explosion.
I did like the fact that we got Gracie Law, you know, Kim Cattrall's character, saying that, oh my God, you know, green eyes is like leather bucket seats with these people. And I'm like, ooh.
That's right.
These people.
Well, it's a different era. And she was a social justice warrior in that movie. Long before it was in vogue to be a social justice warrior.
Because she's Gracie Law.
Don't panic. It's me, Gracie Law.
Yep.
But we are getting a little ahead of ourselves.
Sorry.
That's
sorry,
okay.
Sorry.
You're all excited. We appreciate your enthusiasm.
We are so excited right now.
Just stay in the sleeper section of the truck and you'll be called.
Right. So yeah, let's get started. I mean, it starts with Jack continuing that monologue of his. He has numerous monologues throughout the film. Usually he's yapping on his CB, but here he's kind of talking to Uncle Chu about how, you know, the whole China is here. He doesn't know what that means. But the first thing I want to mention on here is that you see that old payphone on the wall. And I mean, it really does date this movie. I mean, this was 1986. This was a time when there were payphones. I think you'd be hard-pressed to really find any of those today.
I just thought it was weird that he was using a payphone in their kitchen. Mm-hmm. So does Uncle Chu make the staff use nickels or dimes in order to make a call?
Boss.
He literally like is nickeling and diming them. Yeah.
Yes, like literally to make a phone call, you have to use like anyway. I thought that was very interesting.
You're just jealous of Uncle Chu and his success in the restaurant industry. You think it's easy running the Dragon of the Black Pool?
No, I don't. And having all that knowledge,
no,
of spirit mediums.
This is true, but he's Uncle Chu.
Yeah, he did lay down some knowledge on him, didn't he?
You know, I think in the last episode, we were just getting to Uncle Chu. Did you have any information on, I assume he's not really named Uncle Chu.
Yeah, no, I do have it. His name is Chow Lee Chi, So he was actually born in China. He was born in Shanxi province in 1927. Unfortunately, he passed away in October 2010, but he lived for quite a while. According to what I've read on IMDb, it said that he moved to New York in 1939 after the Japanese invasion of China.
Wow.
And eventually, he studied and taught philosophy. As a younger man, he was a practitioner of modern dance, judo, aikido, tai chi, ballet, and fencing. And some other stuff about him.
It says here,
in later years, he helped bring Taoism to America by forming the Taoist Sanctuary in Los Angeles.
You know, actually, that does ring a bell that I think I read a while back that, you know, he was in a film of the experimental filmmaker Maya Deering. He was an actor in the 40s. He had she was doing one of her experimental films in New York. And I think he was a subject of one of her experimental films. So you just never know with people.
It's weird, though. I mean, I see him as just this older man, this Uncle Chu character. And it's hard for me to imagine that here's somebody who was all into dance, ballet, and fencing. But yeah, I mean, by the time he was filming this, he was closer to 60.
Yeah, he was 83 when he died. Crazy.
Yeah, that's a long time. The other little things just says that he did stage work over the years, but his big break was on the TV series Falcon Crest in the 80s. He played the role of Chow Lee. I don't remember Falcon
Crest. That's special. Sort of remember watching that show. Like, you know, my mom would not let me watch something else. That's my memory of that show.
You should be thanking your mom for making you watch such an awesome TV show.
Hey, I will thank her for Dallas.
Oh, okay.
But I will not thank her for Falcon Crest.
How about Knots Landing? There you go.
I kind of remember Chow Lee on Falcon Crest a little bit. He was like the sinister assistant to Jane Wyman's character.
Sinister assistant?
Yeah, he was like her sinister manservant, I think.
That's what I want to be for Halloween, a sinister manservant.
You got to have like a tuxedo and tails for that. Yeah, I got to wear white gloves. It's mandatory.
All right.
Yeah, just
note to self.
Can't be a cat servant anymore. You know.
That's my full-time job.
Do you notice that there's very convenient thunder and lightning that interrupts Wang when he tries to mollify Jack? You kind of hear this stock thunderclap sound effect, and it's something that comes up quite a bit throughout the film. It's very comic book-like. It seems to like punctuate specific lines. Kind of calls back to one of the earlier episodes, I think, Brett, when you were saying that even the action that happens in the alley, it has a very comic book feel. And I think that kind of comes across from the W.D. Richter script. You've got these comic book sound effects of thunderclaps and something out of a cartoon.
Yeah, you notice, in the first couple minutes as the character's in the kitchen, the dialogue is a bit out of this world. It's rather comic booky and melodramatic. So
the movie's a lot of things, but it is a supernatural thriller. That side to it. So you can't have a supernatural tale without thunder and lightning accompanying it.
Now, is that possibly a hint or a reminder that, you know, our arch enemies are the storms?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I definitely think so.
They're listening. You know, like, we know where you are.
Well, it just adds to the ominous nature of everything that's going on. Like, they are fighting literally the forces of nature, you know, and magic and mysticism, and Jack Burton being the everyman into this sort of, I guess, hidden world. And that's why it's so important when Gracie Law shows up real quick, that when he says, like, when we start talking about what they're going to need to do, and he says, "I'm starting to sound like an outsider," you know, and she's all, "You are." Mm-hmm. It's because he is, you know, he is the viewer's eyes, you know, into this mystical world that very few outsiders are able to get into. And Gracie Law is because of how strong her personality is. It's just a really, like, it's really interesting, you know, like, he really goes on sort of this kind of hero's journey, you know, in the movie.
Mm-hmm. He's also really full of himself.
Do you think, I mean, Josh, this question would be for you maybe, but do you think that the audience is supposed to identify with Jack?
I think that the audience by default would identify with him. But as we were talking in an earlier episode, he is not really the hero of the story. If anything, he's more of a sidekick, and Wang is the hero. But to answer your question, you know, he is a fish out of water in this case, and you know, maybe audiences would just sort of identify with all the craziness going on.
But as a counterpoint, his character believes him to be the hero, and that's, and I think that's what pushes him over the top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's sort of that arrogance that allows him to believe that it's all about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and is that a reflection on like America at the time? Is John Carpenter trying to say that about Americans, and you know, coming into something they have no business being with, because he's so very cavalier in everything he does.
Yeah.
You know, even when he's on the phone talking to the insurance agency, he's just like, you know, it's very much like, you should know me and blah blah blah, and so sort of like, you know, he's this very larger than life character, which many American movie stars, you know, are.
And hence the John Wayne impersonation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just one big
ugly American.
You know, there's going to be a line that comes up later where he just says, okay, everybody relax, I'm here.
Yeah. Yep.
That's his character, yeah. And that perhaps is reflective of just, you know, Americans in general as maybe seen by the outside world, or, you know, maybe seen by, you know, people in Chinatown who, you know, they think, you know, this is where we live, this is what we do, and, you know, what are you doing here in our place?
But also, as a counter, he is constantly asked by Wang to help him,
mm-hmm.
you know, to help him, you know, help me do this, we need your help more, we need you to do this. So Jack is more than willing to play the role of the hero.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's just one of his strong things. It's just like, no matter what, you know, he's willing to do that. And whether it's he's gonna get his money, you know, double or triple, double or nothing, whatever, you know, is that really what's going on, or is Wang really his friend? Because like Wang's putting a lot of faith, you know, in Jack Burton. Like a lot of faith.
Oh yeah. Yeah, later he even has a line where he just says, you know, my destiny rests in your capable hands. I mean, you could take that as kind of like an ironic statement, but I mean, the way that Dennis Dunn delivers it, it sounds pretty sincere. He really does rely on his friend.
And just their friendship is just so Batman and Robin, sort of very naive, but he's the one, you know, the sidekick, you know. Their relationship is just so like, you know, he's very like, kind of beholden to Jack, almost.
Though that will change. A lot of characters in this movie do go through transition.
Yeah.
By the end of the movie, Wang is not like that anymore. I mean, he's strong. He's doing his thing. You know, I'm thinking of, we'll get to it later. The whole, he takes them all out. Time to go. he's in control by that time.
Yeah.
Part of it, another thing that we had on a previous episode was kind of cool. It's kind of reflected in their outfits too, because if you look at Jack at the beginning of the movie, he's wearing that whole poncho that you were referring to before, Brett. You know, he's got the outfit, he's got the hat, but later on, you know, he starts to lose some of the clothing when he's in his trademark Fu Manchu tank and, you know, his hat. I mean, you know, now he's more of a, you know, a man who's ready to do business, even if it means shooting the ceiling and something falls on your head.
Yeah. He's much more exposed.
Well, you bring this up that he's in the kitchen. His clothing is hanging on the hanging up to dry. And by the way, those jeans, you got the feeling they will never be dry.
Those jeans. You really did.
Yeah.
Oh my Lord.
But ultimately he's losing part of his identity. It's part of a metamorphosis he's going through in the kitchen.
That's
isn't
right.
it? And he's wearing a robe, a Chinese robe.
Yep.
He's sort of embedding himself into their culture, or at least it's alluding to he's about to.
Very awkwardly, too. You know, that robe, it's...
Is there anything not awkward about Jack?
Well, but you allude to a really great thing. It's like he is literally a stranger in a strange land. Like, he's losing his clothing. It's on the line. It's wet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has to put his faith in these people that, you know, are supposed to, like, help him. And, like, he's on the phone with the insurance company, and the insurance company, you know, can't help him. And he's just trying so hard to, like, get out and just to find his way out of this, and he can't. And then he's like, oh, well, I gotta go do this. So, you know.
Right, he loses his connection with the outside world.
Exactly.
He literally loses his connection on the phone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So he's kind of trapped, you know, in. But, you know, being the hero, he will persevere.
Mm-hmm.
a quote-unquote hero.
In his mind. Again, this is all on his mind. In his mind.
Good point.
In his mind, he can do no wrong. Like, he can't. Like, everything will work out for him. Typical American. Everything will work out for him. Period.
I mean, not to take away his hero status, though. I mean, he, you know, the stuff he does is heroic. It's just that in some cases, it might be accidentally heroic. You know, he, if anything, well, we'll get to it as we go on. I really want to
hear, because I've always talked a lot about, you know, Jack Burton's heroic status and what he really did, you know. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who might not have seen it, but and I would really like to like really pick people's brains about this. But when you look at the movie, how heroic is he, honestly? Honestly, like, how heroic is he?
His moccasins are cool.
You know, I mean, is he heroic because he did the penultimate thing? Or because I believe that the people around him were a bit more heroic than him, like in all of the little incremental things that happened throughout that movie. It's very weird when you think about it. Like, he's in this giant, you know, he's held in this giant regard, you know, higher standards, and it's like, really, what did he really do? You know,
Desmond, with your comic book background, can you think of a comic book character that kind of is similar to how Jack Burton is treated in this film?
That's almost every comic book character, you know. That's you know, but again, a lot of the comic characters, like, you know, like Batman and Spider-Man, and all these people, they have had these really sad things that have defined them and made them, you know, who they are. And then they've had these long histories of ways to show their heroic deeds. Jack Burton really hasn't had that.
No. You know?
And that's always the thing. It's like he's a comic book character. He is a 100% comic book character, you know, living, walking, breathing comic character, you know, and that's what's awesome about it, you know, because in comic books, there's always, you know, there's always that one thing, that one defining moment that makes them, you know, usually something tragic, because tragedy sells. But there's always that one thing that happens.
I thought it was sex all this time.
Oh, no. That's
tragic sex sells. Yeah, let's face it.
That's thumbs up, Brett. Thumbs up. But for him, his defining moment didn't happen until the end of the movie. That's what I thought was really kind of funny about him. It's like, through this whole time, he thinks he's just like, you know, hop. But, you know, really, it's like, really, what is he? You know? So I really liked when Audra was talking about he was all stripped down. You know, he's like, he has nothing to do. And then on top of that, you know, Wang tells him, I can't pay your money right now. And he's like, what? It's like he's literally like, really like, just like, what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. Great. That whole scene is as Jack is descending into this, you know, descending deeper and deeper and deeper into this, you know, in the hero's journey into the underground, you know?
Yeah.
So
now,
Chinese got a lot of hells.
Oh, they definitely do. Yeah, we're actually going to be getting to some of that pretty soon. But moving forward in the minutes, I wanted to introduce our next character here, and that's Eddie. Eddie appears in that dapper plaid green and purple suit that would make the Joker proud.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he's played by actor Donald Lee. I have a little bit about him. Donald Lee, according to Internet Movie Database, was born in 1961 in Hong Kong. Though, strangely enough, I have the Big Trouble in Little China press kit from the 1980s, and it says that he was born in Jersey City, New Jersey in 1955. So, I don't know which one is right there. His acting credits include one...
Suspicious.
Yeah, I know. His acting credits include One Crazy Summer.
My favorite.
Yep.
And he also had a chance to work with John Carpenter again in Memoirs of an Invisible Man with Chevy Chase. And most recently, he had a role in the Marvel Avengers movie. But other than that, he's just had sort of small TV roles, ranging from stuff in The Equalizer and Knots Landing to a more recent role in Days of Our Lives. That's Donald Lee as Eddie.
Yeah, working actor. That's cool. The thing I like about Eddie is he seems like a throwback to a 1930s character. There's something about him that I could picture him in a 1930s movie. Is who would play him? I don't know, but there's, he's a, I don't know, just because he's got sort of this bubbling energy and he, something about the suit too. He's so nattily dressed.
Very suave.
Very suave. Very suave.
Yeah, I like his line when he gets introduced as the maitre d' of the Blackpool. He's like, and a whole lot more.
Yeah.
And that kind of defines cool. his character.
Eddie yeah, and you think cool. he might be maybe like a lounge singer there too. Maybe that's what he meant.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah.
Every Thursday night he does a set.
Yeah, I could see him.
Dean Martin covers.
Oh, yeah, I could see him as the Dean Martin of Chinatown. Mm-hmm.
I never viewed him as a comedic, like.
Relief.
I never saw him as, you know, comedic relief. And he, like, everyone in the movie brings something to the table. Like, mm-hmm. every one of them does something or is, you know, intricate.
Yeah, they all have their function, a purpose.
Exactly. And that's what I like about it. Like, no character is wasted. No one.
Yeah. And when you mentioned earlier about Jack being an outsider, yeah, it's Eddie who, you know, what did he say? You know, I've heard a lot about you. And he, you know, kind of rolls his eyes a bit. So you're Jack Burton, huh?
Well, I think, and if we're going to talk about, you know, assimilation into like Western culture, I think Eddie is the one that is the most assimilated, though.
Yeah.
Hmm. So I think that he is that little, like, you know, oh, so you're this, you know, big shot guy, you know, but really, are you?
Yeah.
So he's the one that's kind of like not so much buying into Jack's, you know, what Jack is selling, you know, like I really want a prequel. About how Jack and Wang met, like why does Wang? I'm still back to that because I wonder. I've always wondered why Wang holds him in such high regard.
Desmond, get on it. Yeah, copyright that immediately.
Prequel.
Well, you know, Eric Powell is actually writing a comic, the Big Trouble in Little China comic that takes place after this movie ended. So there's a little bit of stuff going on and with another sorcerer and all this other stuff.
But yeah, what happened before? Yeah, that's the thing. He's actually referred to, Wang does refer to Jack as his dear friend Jack Burton. So they do have a history, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. Were they in a war together or something?
They were lovers.
Oh.
Well, that sure would be a twist.
Well, now we know what broke up Jack's marriage.
And why he didn't say I love you to Gracie Law at the end.
Okay. It all comes together. It all comes together. But yeah, and speaking of Gracie Law, are we at the point?
Are we done with? Are we done with?
Almost.
Eddie?
I just wanted to mention here. I mean, he's basically used to fill in a lot of exposition, as Brett had mentioned earlier. He seems to know a lot about the goings on of the Lords of Death.
You know, yep.
He's the one who found out that the Lords of Death stole Jack's truck, and fills us in about that funeral. Telling us that it was Mr. Len Lee, the boss of the Chang Sings, that was ordered assassinated by David Lo Pan, and that his Len Lee's funeral was in the alley. So yeah, that's what you get from Eddie.
He's really in the know. So I don't know. It's like, what's going on with Eddie? Like, is Eddie a little dirty? You know, does he know what's going on, or does he just have his ear to the ground? Like,
he's got his finger on the pulse of Chinatown.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know,
he's a good maitre d'. He knows people. He's a people person.
There you go.
Well, it makes me think that, you know, that you know, the uncle is really most likely well known in the community as well. So So these are not just, you know, unknown, you know, Chinese folks, and like they have status, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, in the neighborhood and in the community is what I think.
Yeah. These guys are insiders. As Jack is the outsider, you know, people like Eddie, people like Uncle Chu, they know everything that's going on in China, and it is little China for a reason.
I agree.
Now we can get to the next character, I think. And that would be Gracie Law. Now my question is, before she enters in here, notice that she's got this kind of look. You think it's almost like an old woman with a cane who comes in. Why take that approach? Why all the cloak and dagger?
Because she's hated. She even says it. You know, because she's a social justice warrior. I mean, why she was there to pick up the girl and bring her, you know, to a safe space. I mean, she's, you know, she is she's that character. You know, she's the. I think that she is the feminine antithesis of Jack Burton.
Yeah.
She is his opposite in every way. She is just as strong, just as powerful. And here's the difference. She has actually done things to make a difference in this community, which, you know, while she is embedded in the streets with the people trying to save them, Jack is just trying to get out. So, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, she doesn't like him a little bit, but there's this weird kind of tension between the two of them. Like, that's how I see, you know, Gracie Law and Jack Burton's, you know, relationship. Because I remember correctly, there's really only a total of three white people in this movie. You know, the third one is the reporter.
The reporter
who wants to break, quote unquote, break it right wide open. You know, so whereas Jack is the outsider, you know, Anglo, she is like deeply embedded. So much so that her eyes are green. Like, is that a little bit more telling, you know, about her character? You know, that she needs to be there.
Very interesting. You know,
there's more of a purpose for her to be there.
Right, so she's sort of like anti-human trafficking, right?
That's exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's all about like getting them, you know, getting you know, to quote, fresh off the boat, you know, Chinese folks who are coming to America as immigrants. Like, she's there to get them into housing and so they don't fall into the human trafficking, right? You know, which we see later on in this clip as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, so she's disturbing the economy in Chinatown, so she is undercover, as you say.
Correct.
Now, the name itself, Gracie Law, you know, and she's a lawyer. I wonder if that's supposed to be her real name as the character or not. I mean, in a sense, it almost sounds like Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad. Gracie Law.
Better call Gracie.
little things I noticed when I was watching these scenes closely. Notice that Gracie's wearing four pins on her, I guess that's her sweater. One of them, it looks like it's a Chinese symbol. And I wonder if some of that has to do with the fact that she's the person who's standing up for human rights and, you know, against Chinese girl trafficking. Maybe those pins are related somehow.
It's funny. I noticed those pins and I just thought, oh yeah, it's a nice 80s touch.
But again, I think it just solidifies her into the community.
Yeah.
You know, she is sporting, you know, the clothing of the culture that she is, you know, trying to be, you know, trying to be assimilated into.
Yeah. She's very adamant that this is my neighborhood, you know, when asked about that.
Yeah.
Now, Audra, when you first saw Big Trouble in Little China, what was your thought of the character of Gracie Law?
It's really interesting how she comes in this scene in particular and just sort of like as if to show off just how plucky she is. She has to like point out like, I'm always putting my nose in the wrong place. I'm always that's me. And she sort of defines herself over and over again. Throughout the movie and as she does in this scene, there's something very stilted about her delivery, which I find interesting. Her take on that as an actor. I gotta say, I don't know much of her career except for this and Sex in the City.
Yeah.
So well, I don't know if this was her thing. Oh, Mannequin. She was in Mannequin.
Yeah, Mannequin.
And Star Trek VI. Hey, wait a minute. Brett.
I totally forgot about Star Trek 6.
Brett, yes, here, totally forgot about this. Could be a great opportunity to tell that story, the Star Trek 6 and Kim Cattrall thing.
Okay, so who knows this Kim Cattrall Star Trek 6 story?
No, I forgot she was even in that movie.
Well, she's a Vulcan. She's supposed to be...
Hot.
she's a hot Vulcan. She's, you know, a protege of Spock. He's kind of mentoring her. So there is this story I heard years ago that as a gag, just as for a joke, Kim Cattrall posed on the set of The Bridge on the helm console, a nude.
What?
Yeah, she did it. She posed nude, except she had her...
She had the forehead.
She had her wig and her Vulcan ears.
Ears.
And she did a cheesecake nude photo on the... man, I'm a Trekkie and I don't even... The console, you know, where Sulu and Chekhov are, you know,
that
pushing
works.
Buttons.
Wow.
And then...
The steering wheel.
Yeah, so she just did it, I guess, as a lark. Leonard Nimoy found out And he was really upset. And apparently he went up to her and he said, you know, this is a franchise and a lot of people believe. And then he kind of stood up for the franchise and he said, you know, I don't like what you did. You kind of disrespected our franchise here. So she apparently said, okay, well, see, I'm sorry. I just thought it would be funny. Gave him the negatives. And
fascinating.
You said Nimoy, right?
Yeah, it's Nimoy.
You know, late in Nimoy's life, he actually did a nude series with a bunch of burlesque
that's
dancers.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Was he in Spock face?
While he took the photos?
Yeah.
We can only hope.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, maybe to defend Leonard, maybe he was just, you know, there's the Star Trek and there's my, you know, he separated the two. I don't know. But that was the story I heard years ago.
Wow.
And I would just, I would like to think maybe Kim said, you know, okay, here's all the photos, and maybe she kept a negative.
Well, it was pretty early in her career, so I'm assuming she didn't want to piss people off.
Yeah, apparently, you know, as the story I heard, it was a sort of a, you know, she upset a co-star. So I was like, oh, okay, I apologize. I was just.
That's hilarious. And now you got Jared Leto sending all kinds of crap to his co-stars in Suicide Squad, and it's like, what?
That's a good point. I mean, that's pretty, you know, like many years before the selfie.
Completely different now. completely different. You can just get away with all kinds of, like, what George Clooney does to his co-stars. Ugh. That's awesome.
Anyway, fellow listeners out there, Star Trek fans, if anyone knows of the story of the King Cattrall photo, and, you know, I know there's a negative out there somewhere. It's in a strong box.
Can only hope so. Yeah. Please, Internet, come through for us.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, it would be awesome. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
Well, back to the minutes. We were talking before about all the different Chinese hells. So here is our first Chinese hell reference. And if you wanted to turn this into a drinking game, then you'd probably be pretty far along by the end of the movie. This is the first hell that's mentioned, the hell of being cut to pieces. And I can also tell you that in the screenplay, there's more hells that are mentioned here. Uncle Chu actually mentions that there's also the hell of boiling oil and the hell of the vast cold. And what the hell is Gracie Law doing here?
The hell of Gracie Law.
Yeah, Chinese people do have a lot of hells. I did I studied a lot of Chinese mythology. And I think there's like anywhere from like 8 to 12 different levels of hell. And it's all housed in a mountain range. Like the gateway to hell is in this mountain range in one of the provinces in China.
It's like Dante.
Yeah, and there's a mountain range you just walk into, you can go into, and that's where all the hells are, all different levels of hell. There's the hell of, you know, being cut up, boiled, you know,
so all these,
the knife.
All these names are then, they're related to the actual hells then?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, that's what's so cool about it. It's like all those hells existed in Chinese mythology.
Wow. I'm going to have to look up the hell of the upside down sinners when we get to that.
Yep.
It's funny though, the way Eddie says the Chinese have a lot of hells, I just imagine they're like 67. So to say, you know, 8 to 12 hells, that's a lot of hells.
Well, but that's the thing. Like you start at one hell and you kind of like, you, because what I understand with Chinese hells is you just kind of, you die and then you, so this is why, you know, Chinese, you know, burn money. It's what you can, because everything is, you can barter with anything, even in the afterlife. And so they use the money in order to have a better position in hell, because it's like you get up in the morning, you go, and then you get tortured, ooh, you know, all day, and then you go home, you know, it's sort of like what it is. And so, and so you can kind of like buy your way further up in the bureaucracy before you are judged by I can never say the name, but he's the lord of hell, and if you've paid your sins, you get a ride on the wheel of reincarnation and you go back to earth.
So if you've paid your dues,
yep, if you've suffered enough for all your transgressions while you were alive, then you get reincarnated. And you can buy your way higher up the food chain. That's why they burn money, so you can use that money in the afterlife.
So you might be able to say to Yuma, the check is in the mail?
No, I think you have to pay up front.
Okay, pay up front. Okay.
So yeah.
That won't
no CODs.
Yeah. And it's hell, so there's no ATMs nearby. You know? Or at least not your banks, the ATMs.
I just like the concept of hell being like a 9-to-5 thing.
Well, yeah, it's like you just kind of go and you do your hell, and you come back, and you just kind of.
Reminds me of those old Warner Brothers cartoons with the sheepdog and the wolf.
Oh right,
morning Ralph, morning Sam, and clock in, and then you know all hell would break loose, and then you know, yeah, up 5 o'clock. All right, we'll pick it up tomorrow.
Hellacious lunch break.
No, and then the like the Oxen Guard were these people who look like as sort of like minotaurs, and they were these demons or the oni or not oni's Japanese, but these demons that basically made sure that you were getting punished enough.
No.
So.
I don't know, Desmond. This sounds like the plot line of a future Jack Burton comic adventure.
There you go.
Jack goes to hell.
Nice. So yeah, so this was one of the movies that really got me interested in like Chinese mythology and all the stuff.
This movie,
yeah, when I first saw it, is really what got me into like Chinese mythology, because like you can do a whole series on the really cool like Sammo Hung Chinese mythology movies and all the movies that were done, like so much mysticism.
Yeah, the fantasy movies.
Hopping vampires and all this other stuff. So
yeah, I was reading, I think it was in Entertainment Weekly when they were talking about Big Trouble in Little China, that apparently W.D. Richter needed to do quite a bit of research for this to make sure that the Chinese mythology elements were in there. And this was at a time when you couldn't just pull up Wikipedia. I mean, he had to go to the library and get just dozens of books and totally immerse himself in it in time to be able to write this screenplay. And it shows. It's got this real stuff. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and even what Lo Pan is wearing throughout the whole thing is just like amazing.
Yeah,
like the costuming in this movie is just phenomenal.
Yeah, it's Desmond. It's pretty cool to hear. You know, here's this way out comic book of a movie. Yeah, you're saying how, you know, it influenced your studies, and we had Dennis Rule on a couple episodes back, and this was the movie that really got him interested in martial arts. So. Yeah, here's this big, wacky, crazy movie that we love, but yet it's influencing people's lives, which that's pretty cool.
Which I never really thought that this would happen, only because like mostly all of John Carpenter's early movies, I couldn't watch because like when I was younger, I really couldn't stand the horror, like, you know, In the Mouth of Madness and Prince of Darkness and The Thing. Like I couldn't stand that stuff when I was a kid. So to have this movie and me being like a little, you know, black kid and into martial arts and everything like that, I was finally able to get in on the John Carpenter stuff. I was like, yeah, I can get it. Like, and I like Halloween because that wasn't like supernatural stuff like that. But this was like so like, oh my God, it had everything in it that I wanted. Yeah. I was just so excited as a little kid. Yeah, and I would watch it all the time when it came on cable. It's like, yeah.
Made me want to move to San Francisco.
For that San Francisco. It's all soundstage.
Moving along, Gracie is the one who continues doing all the exposition, you know, more about what's going on in Chinatown.
It's like an exposition explosion in that kitchen.
She's very pushy.
Back and forth.
Absolutely.
Everybody.
Pushy,
She's very...
Not assertive.
No, she was pushy. No, she was pushy.
In the W.D. Richter screenplay, Gracie's not actually in the scene at all. She's not in the restaurant. All of these lines came from Eddie. So they made a switch later. I guess they really wanted to get Kim in there a bit more.
That's really interesting because, you know, I mean, there's that one moment in the kitchen where, you know, Gracie's doing her exposition and it's like Eddie's ignoring her and he's just continuing with his story.
Mm-hmm.
So to hear that was all together, that's really interesting.
Why do you think they did that? Like, that's interesting why they felt that they needed her to be there and they took it away from Eddie. I thought it was more to see the interaction between her and Jack, you know, because I think it really strengthened her character.
Yeah,
to have her be so knowledgeable, like she's a very assertive, you know, woman.
Thank you.
In this very male dominated movie, you know, she's very like, I'm not taking from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the later ones, when she gets captured and she's all trying to bite his fingers, I was just like, she's no damsel in distress, you know?
Yeah, absolutely not. I have a note here that Jack just still can't figure out what's going on while everybody else seems to get it. This is a common theme. Even Lo Pan calls him out on that later.
He does. I don't think he ever gets it. And that's why, you know, he's just so oblivious.
He's so good at not getting it, though.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of mastered not getting it.
Yeah, he starts hearing Uncle Chu give his description of Lopan, you know, about the medium and mystical powers. And just his line, he's like, what?
Yep. Yeah. It was a mouthful of food. What?
Yeah.
Yep.
Huh?
But then it speaks to the whole generationalism between Chu and his nephew, Wang.
Right.
How, like, you know, Wang is like, no, it's nothing like that. It's something different, you know? And so Wang is like completely turning his back, you know, against his heritage and everything, you know? And he's like, no, 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 it's not like that. It's like that, you know? So he knows the truth, but he is like, no, 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 no. It's not like that at all, Jack. It's something completely different. No, you know? And I'm wondering, is he doing that because he's trying to not scare his friend, or is he doing it because he doesn't want to believe either?
Or like the younger generation just turns their back on the magic. You know, like they're done with.
I think it might be a mixture of both. Later on, there's going to be that scene where he starts talking about the Chinese mythology with Jack, and he says it's like he didn't really want to believe it, but it is real.
Yeah,
it comes later.
That was right after the hell of upside down sinners.
That's
yeah.
Right. So at this point in the movie, though, I think he's just trying to mollify Jack to try to make sure that he goes with him, but maybe it is something he's not totally convinced with yet. And that convincing will have to come later. So now, at this point, we're ready to leave the Dragon of the Black Pool. Anything else to mention about that before we step outside?
Hey, time is money.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Jack is just like, you know, I'll do it. You know, he's just so like, that's one thing. It's like he's so giving up his time, but is that because he's conceited? And he's like, oh, you can't do this without me? Or, and then Gracie is just completely cutting him down. You have to look like something. You have to look stupid. He does, you know, and it's just like you can't be noticed. And he's like, you know, he won't. And just like that stuff that Gracie is just kind of like, he's just like cutting him down. It's very funny.
Yeah. Of course, he's kind of impervious to it.
Yeah. He doesn't. That's the thing. It's like he is Teflon in this movie. This man is Teflon. He just cannot be. He can't be stopped.
And maybe
stop him. But, you know, even then.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's why ultimately it is his destiny, because, yeah, he can't be stopped. His ego is too big.
And what action hero has such a low body count? Really? You know, that's later, Bo. Mm.
That's a little refreshing in this age where, yeah, you are talking about heroes and the body counts. And he doesn't need to have a high body count.
Yeah, that's true.
You could say the opposite. Hey, I got through this with, you know, minimal casualties.
Now, do you guys notice that once they get to Chinatown outside in the rain at night, that there's a brilliant 1960s style pink Cadillac that drives up?
Oh,
that,
yeah.
You know, that's Eddie's car.
Eddie's Sweet Red.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you. Once again, you can tell you're in an 80s movie because there's a gigantic pink Cadillac. That's such a touch from that era.
And you can tell you're in San Francisco because it's raining. Like, my God, there's so much rain in this movie.
Yeah.
And you have to remember that, because when you get to the end of the movie, you have to mention that. At the end of the movie, throughout all the going into the movie, it's always ominous. The weather is always bad. The weather is always crazy. I'm jumping ahead, but you have to remember this. When you guys, I might not be on the show at the end, but when you get to the end, when they're in the truck, look at the scenery. Just saying. At the scenery.
All right.
Because I was just like,
are you giving a weather spoiler?
What the hell? just look at it, because you'll be like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
Look at it. Well, it's a dark and stormy night here right now.
Yeah.
And there are these storms that are, we haven't seen them in a few minutes, but the storms are around. But you're right. This is a very, if you will, a wet movie.
Very wet.
It's a very, very damp movie.
This is a family podcast.
Oh, okay.
Very damp.
Hit the air horn.
But seriously, everyone is very damp in this movie. Like they keep jumping in and out of water. There's rain. It's like
it's a very moist movie.
And then they go underground, and there's like bubbling water, and it's just like, yes, it's a very moist movie.
Yeah, if we wanted to add to the drinking game aspect of the game, just counting the number of scenes where somebody has wet clothing, you'd probably all get drunk pretty quickly.
Yep, people are getting drenched in this movie. No wonder. Kurt Russell had a fever. I mean, come on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was sick during this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, was he?
You didn't know that?
No, I heard about it. Yeah.
No.
The flu?
Yeah, no.
You knew about that, right?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, yeah. He was really, really sick. And some of the scenes you can tell he's like completely sweating because he's just like, he had this like 102 fever or something, but he was working through it. Yeah, he was really sick during the making of this movie.
Wow.
Yeah, I read about that just recently. There's one pro. Like you said, there's one scene where there's a close up and you know, they didn't have to give him that gelatin or whatever they make you to
glycerin.
But that was the thing that always made me wonder. And I always wanted to ask him, if I ever got to meet him, I'd ask him. So in all these, in the whole movie, were you just really, really, really tired because you were fighting a cold? Because if you notice, sometimes he seems really like, you know, just, and I'm thinking, are you acting or is this really because you're sick? Like you have a cold. Hmm. Like I always wanted to ask you about that. Like did this cold ever influence your acting?
It was serious method.
Yeah, I'm assuming.
Probably. You know,
having to be wet all the time and jumping in and out of water. Ugh.
Well, I do want to get back to the fact that in the script, it actually differs from what we see in the film at this point. In the W.D. Richter screenplay, before they get to the White Tigers, they actually travel to Stockton Street through a Chinese market, and they get to this old Chinese garment factory complete with dozens of women workers. And it's mentioned that that's a front for a slave trade, a Chinese prostitution racket. In fact, there's even a little thing that Richter writes in the comments. He says that 30 Chinese girls are scattered around, smoking, sleeping, watching daytime TV, and wearing loose kimonos that seem far more tragic than sexy to Jack. And when they're inside there, they meet a Tibetan slave trader named Joe Ho Bhattacharji. And when Jack asks about green eyes, Joe has the line that Chinese girls don't come with green eyes. And then later, a doorman overhears the conversation that he's having about asking about the Chinese girl with the green eyes. And so for $100, he tells them about the White Tigers. And then it transitions over to there with Gracie and Margot then sort of spying on them and seeing what's going on.
So I want to see that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a huge sequence that they cut.
I don't know. Like, I kind of like that they didn't go with that.
Why is that?
It takes it out of a fantasy. Hmm. You know, yeah. And I think that's kind of weird. You know, it's a huge tonal shift. Mm-hmm. You know.
And yes, you know, one thing I've noted in previous episodes is, yeah, this movie starts somewhat grounded in a certain level of reality. And it just goes, as Jack gets deeper into it, it turns more and more into this cartoon-like adventure. It gets more and more just weirder and weirder.
And that stuff is not weird and cartoony. That's just sad. And it's like, wow. Yeah. You know, so.
Yeah, you think that's why it was cut, Josh?
I think Desmond has a good point. It makes it sort of too much grounded into problems in the real world. And this is ultimately supposed to be a sort of fun, cartoony fantasy humor type thing. So,
8 foot tall, bodiless ghost wizard.
Floating through walls.
With light coming out of his mouth.
Yeah. So that's kind of, he runs Chinatown. So he's more interested in, you know, feeding the Yeren and stuff like that. I wanted to get back to the Cadillac, the pink Cadillac, your 80s iconic car.
Back to the car.
The main thing. There's some important car stuff to talk about.
And here. The Pontiac.
Yeah. The Pontiacs. You know, we talked about the Pontiacs. Mm-hmm. The Lords of Death are sponsored by Pontiac. We talked about that.
And the Fiero.
Pearl Grey Fiero. Very Fiero. Important. But you know, we were talking about Eddie and how he's grounded and he's very Americanized and he's got the suit. And he's the guy with the Cadillac. That's his car. I mean, that's an American status symbol, a Cadillac.
Mm-hmm. You would not be able to drive that down a single street in Chinatown.
No. No, that thing
is carefully.
It's a battleship. But it's
grazing the buildings. Yeah. Just very,
but it's also to point out this street is definitely not Chinatown. It looks like something on the Fox lot. Totally looks like Laverne and Shirley.
Come on,
Street.
That could be on California and Grand, right there where there were the cable cars. It could be one of those big ass buildings.
No, it's way too.
There isn't a single intersection in San Francisco that's that big.
No.
I mean, it's somewhere on the Fox lot, so you're more likely to see, you know, Adam West and Burt Ward come out of one of those buildings.
I was so depressed, you know, after seeing that, because, like, Because like Chinatown did not look anything like that. No.
You're like, what's this place? Small, yeah. Smells funny.
And again, it's a very 80s kind of thing because you've got all these neon signs everywhere.
Oh, and I wanted to go underneath Chinatown so bad, but anyway,
the
that's
opium
later.
Dens?
That's later.
Yeah.
But tunnels. Then, yeah, from there, then we get our first entrance into the White Tigers, and we get Henry Swanson making his appearance.
Henry Swanson.
Complete with the paisley suit, the glasses, and the mullet.
So did they just have a bunch of costumes in the trunk? Is that Eddie's thing? Just has just
where
a
they,
ton of...
Yeah, where they get the costumes from?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, according to the Richter script, it actually says that the Henry Swanson disguise had Jack dressed semi-formal in one of Eddie's loud ties and this Ozzie Nelson sport coat scrounged from God knows where.
Nice. Hmm. Nice.
So I got it from Eddie.
To me, it's Russell almost like doing an homage to his Disney films that he did in the early 70s. He looks like a character from a Disney film that he would have been in as a teenager. I mean, if you remember Joe Flynn, with the big, thick glasses. And yeah, he just looks like a character who would have been in the Computer Wars tennis shoes or something like that.
But is this what... But I think it's funny because it's... Is this what they believe a typical American looks like? who would pay for sex? It's like...
Are you saying it isn't?
I mean, in the 80s.
Well, he's supposed to look stupid, so...
I remember when Henry Swanson, quote-unquote, shows up and, you know, being a cool punk rocker at the time. And you think, oh, look at the guy in the 70s clothes. That'll never come back.
Or do you think that maybe it's this Clark Kent?
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, is that the real Jack Burton? Because, you know, one thing I thought about, I mean, I love Henry Swanson and I love Kurt Russell's delivery. But could Jack really pull off, you know, how good an actor is Jack? Could he really pull off this? Hello, my name's Henry Swanson.
Well, it's only to get in. Like, he doesn't really, because, like, the whole thing gets interrupted later
in the
next 5 minutes.
He manages to continue the character and keeping in voice.
Not as well, see, I can't, because, like, it's not the, we're not in the next scene.
Do not go there.
Sorry. But in the next scene, you see him doing his cleaning his glasses when the woman walks in, and then he puffs up his chest and goes back into character, though.
Okay.
You know, this is his Clark Kent, and it's just very kind of funny to me. You know.
Or does meek Henry Swanson from Visalia, California, who hates his life, builds this alter ego of a big tough truck driver named Jack Burton. And, you know, is this really who Jack is?
And it's actually all hallucination on his deathbed.
See, only problem is I can't buy that one only because of how Wang is, you know, because Wang is so devoted to Jack.
Yeah, but if you ever knew
Jack persona,
Jack was really Henry.
Well, that would be more, that's kind of interesting, you know, because like, but I think the Jack is real, you know, given the Pork Chop Express and stuff like that on the CB. You know, does when he's done, does he go to back home, wherever he's back home, and he puts on his glasses?
He
puts on his glasses and, you know, goes into his like his meek wife and everything, kind of sits down and it's like, his wife's all, how was your trip, dear? It was fine.
Yeah, after he gets off the trucker speed for a few days, he reverts back to Henry.
Oh, there you go. It's all a meth-induced.
Yeah.
The whole movie is a meth-induced hallucination.
That would make the most sense out of all these
years. He's like no-dos.
Yeah, he just has a really strong reaction. Well, I got a long truck drive. Well, I guess I'll take these little white pills.
Yeah, right. Because when you think about it, whole movie in movie time only took roughly maybe 2 days. And movie time?
Yeah.
You know what? I actually got somebody emailing me not too long ago, a Big Trouble fan, and he was suggesting that maybe, you know, what's going on is just one sort of speed-induced hallucination. Because do you actually see Jack go to sleep at all during this? I mean,
nope.
He drives in. He does the whole gambling through the night. He, you know, he gets up. He goes through the whole thing with the airport and then the alley, and now he's back. And, yeah, I wonder if there's something there.
Oh, Paul and Pete then Mummer. and then Egg Shen gives him something to drink.
That's right, the medicine.
The medicine.
Medicine. Yeah,
I mean
some medicine.
You know, so I don't know. Maybe there's something to that.
Like I said,
a drug.
Like I said, I think we need to call Pete Mummert here. You know,
calling Mr. Mummert.
Yeah, it's a variation of the Carbonite dream. So it's all a dream.
Shine the Mummert light into the sky.
Yeah, shining the Mummert.
Because what if? Because what if that is really what's happening? What if that's really what's happening? And like Wang and all this family is like, okay, my friend Jack's coming over. I need you guys to play along. You know, he's only gonna be here for a minute.
This crazy speed freak comes over, and we all just pretend.
This white guy comes into town. I play with, you know, I play card games with him. I gotta entertain him for a while, and then he's out of our hair. Just play along. Just play along.
David, can you pretend to be a centuries-old sorcerer who has no body and he's looking for a bride with green eyes?
He's like,
really?
He's like, indeed? Wang's, he's like Wang's great uncle or something. He's like, oh, David, can you please just do this for me? And he's like, sure.
Yeah. Wow. We just basically gutted this movie.
Never watch it the same again.
It's sort of like a Mercedes that we drove to Tijuana and it was totally stripped down to the chassis.
Wow.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah. I do want to move on because we're
yes,
almost at
please.
The
please.
No!
We must pontificate on whether this is all real or not.
We haven't talked about the gremlin that pulls up.
Oh, yeah. We got to talk about the 72 gremlin. Oh. Yeah, I'm not in.
Brown gremlin.
Oh, so that's what it was. I didn't even know what type of car that was.
We identified it as a gremlin, which, Audra, is your.
It is my favorite kind of car, but I really thought that they only came in orange.
Oh, that was Margot's car, right?
Yeah, Margot's car.
Yeah,
yeah.
You guys have a good eye because I didn't know what she was driving. Like, you guys are really good at that. Like, I did not even notice the car. It's, you know, that she was. But remember, she wants her big break. This is her big break.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Something kind of sad, a little unstable about Margot.
Well, actually, that would be a good little transition into Margot. Let me just give a quick little. A little tidbit about Kate Burton, who plays Margot Litzenberger.
Litzenberger?
Yeah, Margot Litzenberger is the character.
No. Lead outsider.
Got to be a Richter name.
Kate Burton is the daughter of actor Richard Burton of Camelot fame. And she was born in Geneva, Switzerland, and then she was raised in New York. Kate Burton's done a lot of stuff lately. She's actually known for her TV work on Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, which earned her 3 Emmy nominations. Plus, she's done stage work that have earned her 3 Tony nominations.
So we have basically 3 different psyches of the outsider in this movie, literally. Like, you could identify with 3 different voices if you wanted to. Actually, more voices if you wanted, because I'm sure there's people that identify with David Lopan and just feel like, kill her, kill her, marry her, marry her.
Indeed.
Like, marry her, yes, yes.
And one of these outsiders drives a sickly brown 72 gremlin.
Well, I do want to introduce one more character, and this is going to be the last one for these 5 minutes. And that's Mrs. O'Toole, who is the woman at the front desk. You know, she's the one who says, oh, just a minute, please. She's actually played by... Yeah, no, she looks great. She's got a very interesting history that Audra will definitely appreciate because she's played by the burlesque dancer Noelle Toy. And Noelle Toy, who was... she was born in 1918 in San Francisco. She died in 2003. She was known as the Chinese Sally Rand, and she was famous as an exotic burlesque dancer in the 1940s, performing nude routines such as the fan dance and the bubble dance in clubs in San Francisco and New York. And I am led to understand, Audra, that you also have a background with burlesque.
That's right. I've actually been working in burlesque since 2004. Maybe a little in 03, but I had a lot of blackouts that year. So, yeah, mostly I've been a dancer and more so an MC, a mistress of ceremonies. So where it's kind of like being a stand-up comedian, except if I start to bomb, I just bring out another naked lady. So it works. It works for me. But, yeah, I'm familiar a little bit with the history of the Asian scene of burlesque that was happening in Chinatown, and there's a pretty good book that's out right now about that. So I'm really interested to look her up now. I mm-hmm. didn't know that.
Yeah, she's done other stuff too in film roles, mostly tied to her exotic dancer background. Apparently, she grew tired of the stereotype of Asian American women in film, and she left acting. But as she got older, she would take small roles in stuff like Policewoman and MASH. It seems kind of appropriate that she's in this movie. I mean, she's playing the madam of this brothel, really. Or is she? Is she supposed to be just like the secretary out front?
I think she's the secretary. Hmm. Or she's like she's just the one I think she does stuff when you just want a regular massage, she's okay. but when Mr. Swanson was like, you know, haha, and she went, oh, just a minute. Yeah. You know,
she went and got the other woman.
Mm-hmm. I love that she had hardly any, if no, accent. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When she was talking, I loved that about her. She was just sort of this kind of like
I am not going to play the stereotype.
Yeah, Asian stereotype. Like, you know, was it Roz? The Kiss My Grits, you know, yeah. From Alice. Like, I totally like felt that was that her character, you know.
Yeah, she had a great, you know, older woman like gravelly voice.
Yep.
Yeah, just a minute, honey.
Exactly. Just a minute.
You know, you could say that at the White Tiger, she's like the maitre d'.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't think brothels need secretaries. They probably more need like a greeter.
But, so
someone's got to do their books.
So maybe she's Eddie's mother.
That'd be a bookkeeper.
Oh. She could do both things. She will not be typecasted.
Maybe she's the plumber. I don't know.
Maybe she's got to get in there and get her hands dirty every now and again, you know?
Oh, man. Desmond.
Maybe it's Lopan in yet another clever disguise.
I don't know. I think Lopan just goes from old to young and that's it.
He doesn't go male, female.
No, I think
that.
He's just old to young. That's okay. It.
Nonetheless, her eyeshadow was flawless.
Yes. Yeah. She looked great.
Yeah.
Like, and that was the thing. Like every Chinese person in this movie looks amazing. Like they like the clothing they're wearing, just everything. Like the costuming was amazing.
Yeah. Well, guys, that pretty much wraps up the 5 minutes. Some good discussions here.
We have run out of time.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having us, you guys.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, no, absolutely.
I thought this was really good. I love talking about this movie. So as you can see, I hope I didn't talk too much. I love you all. Bye.
No, is there anything that you guys would like to plug, stuff that you're doing or working on?
Totally. So I talked a little bit about the burlesque stuff. Also, I do a TV show on the internet called Speak Easily. And Speak Easily is also a comedy troupe that Desmond is part of and my friend Klingon Vanna White is part of. You can find out more and see our comedy sketches and a burlesque talk show that we've done online at speakeasily.tv. Or you can go on Facebook and type in Speak Easily Show and that'll come up there.
And just to add, you've done a lot of... You guys have covered a lot of events, like going to Comic-Con.
Yes, we've got Much Comic-Con, WonderCon, and
Silicon Valley Con.
Silicon Valley Con, all the cons. Con!
All the cons in California, at least.
Yeah. Basically, whatever we can afford to go to, we will go and interview people in funny costumes and make fun of them.
As they make fun of us, because we're usually in funny costumes, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of onesies. So for me, you can check out my other podcast, my podcast that I do with my friend Rich called The Geek Chat. It's a comic book and comic media podcast in which we talk about new comics, graphic novels, and a whole bunch of other stuff like comic-related movies. And then when people are talking on our Facebook group, it's called The Geek Chat. It's live on MixLR on Mondays from 6 to 7. Or you can check out all of our 2 years of shows. We're on our fifth season now on SoundCloud. Just go to SoundCloud and search The Geek Chat, and you will find us. If you want to talk to us, you can always join Facebook. Go to the Facebook groups and join The Geek Chat there. We always posting stuff, talking about stuff. You know, we're definitely going to post about this episode. So, yeah.
Yay.
If you like comics, cool. Come check us out.
One last plug. Desmond and I teamed up and wrote and directed a short film about 4 to 5 years ago, starring none other than one Brett Stillo over
featuring.
Here. Featuring.
Mm-hmm. Featuring. In a
He's
cameo.
In it.
But
he's in it for a couple of minutes.
Where did you shoot my scene?
In Chinatown, in San Francisco.
All goes back to Chinatown, folks.
The movie is called Souls of Splendor. You can find it on YouTube, Souls of Splendor. And it's about gay geek comic book fans. Hmm. So it's a an up and coming niche. More arrived now than when we made the film.
I know, right? Wow. Trendsetters.
Or something.
Nice. I don't know. All right. Well, and as far as our own podcast here, make sure that you please visit us at 5minutesoftrouble.com. Check us out on Facebook at 5 Minutes of Trouble. We also have a new listener society. It's called the 5 Minutes of Trouble Truck Stop. So go ahead and check that out and give your great comments about the podcast or the film in general. We're also on Twitter at 5 Minutes Trouble. And if you can, please tell your friends about this podcast. Give us a nice rating on iTunes. We're also on the Stitcher. We just got added to that not too long ago. I want to give a shout out too to the Star Wars Minute and the Indiana Jones Minute. These are two great podcasts that one of them is just about ending. One of them is probably going to be starting up in a couple of months with their next podcast. We're looking forward to that. And that pretty much wraps it up. So Audra and Desmond, thank you very much for being on the show. This was a lot of fun. I hope you guys had a good time too.
Had a fantastic time. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Thank you so much. Great.
And thank you also to Brett. You know, this is now 6 episodes we've done this moving forward, and I think we're getting our rhythm together. This is working out pretty well.
We're going to get it right at some point. Yeah. So since we're wrapping up episode 6, going to finally let me drive the Pork Chop Express?
I think I can trust you with the keys if you'd like to drive.
Oh, boy. Move over.
I'll just keep my foot on the second brake. That's all. All right, guys. Well, this is the Podcast Express signing off. Tune in next week for another 5 Minutes of Trouble.
Yeehaw!